Well, the operations were all centered in one building in London, Grosvenor Square, I believe. And actually, there was a good deal. I mean, there was an efficient operation from the standpoint of those of us that were traveling for the military organizations. Now, there was a separate committee, I think known as CIOS. I've forgotten exactly what the C and the I is, Civilian Intelligence. It was organized, I believe, under the auspices of the Department of Commerce, or the National Academy of Sciences, I've forgotten which. Those individuals were traveling under the civilian auspices, and they were having a terrible time getting any place because the military wasn't particularly interested in what they were doing, and they used to come over when I was in London and ask me, for heaven's sake, how could they get some access to these things, and the general feeling was that the acronym for that group was CIOS, but it was pronounced chaos because there were fellows from Dow Chemical, I know, that of course Goggin was from Dow Chemical, but he was traveling for the Quartermaster Corps. Actually, I did a good deal of work for Quartermaster in the work at the National Bureau of Standards, and very little for Ordnance, but it just so happened that Ordnance was the first one to invite me, so to represent them. So, but anyway, there was no inefficiency as far as these individuals that were assigned from the military agencies. And I know Dr. Curtis, who was vice president of the Monsanto Company, was over there, and I became a very good friend of his. I had never met him before, but we were compatible and enjoyed talking with each other, and we shared a room in Heidelberg where only he had the rank of general also, because he was vice president of Monsanto. So I drove in the Jeep with him from Munich to Heidelberg, and he said, why don't you come with me to my quarters that I've been assigned to? I'm sure they have two beds, and you might as well have the other bed. And so, of course, I agreed, and it turned out that this was the Schloss Hotel in Heidelberg, and the waiters there, this was still during the wartime, the waiters were in with bow ties and tuxedos, serving in the dining room at the Schloss Hotel, and it was supposed to be a transient hotel where the people stayed only a limited number of days, but like everything else in the Army, if you were in, you were in, and nobody was going to kick you out unless you did something that you shouldn't do or ask too many questions, because as I say, they assigned Curtis a room with two beds because I was living, and he left after about 2 days in the Heidelberg area, and I remained in the room with the double bed by myself, and the sergeant would ask me when I came down in the morning and preparing to go out in the Jeep. Are you leaving, sir? I said, oh, no, I'll be back tonight. So finally, after 3 or 4 days of that, he finally said, do you mind if we move you to a room with a single bed? I said, no, that's perfectly all right with me. So we moved to the single bed, and then he said, and then again the sentry at the door would always say, are you leaving, sir? I said, no, I'll be back. The final day, when I did leave, he could hardly believe it. He said, you're not leaving, are you? But anyway, that's another one of those funny things happened.
What were some of the, I guess the way to phrase this is, what did you find in touring the German plastics plants that was especially of interest?
Well, the highlight, of course, when we went into these plants, all these plants, we asked for the chief chemist or the chemist in charge of operations, and usually they were available, and the staff were available in the neighborhood. It was total destruction. You've seen some of the pictures that I published in Modern Plastics that I took while I was over there. But usually these chemists were living in the area. I don't know in what, but they would, and they were very cooperative in answering our questions regarding the plant. And I remember one fellow, they were talking about polystyrene, and his boss was very surprised to hear one of the chemists speaking such good English. He apparently didn't know that he was conversing in English. I heard him asking where he learned his English. But anyway, we were told in London to look for what were called the QKO, K-U-K-O, QKO reports, which was an abbreviation for reports of the Kunststoffe Commission. And these were reports prepared by the various plants of the IG on the work they were doing on various polymers. They were prepared by the chemists that were in charge. They were submitted to the commission, which was a high-level commission of the executives of the IG from the various plants, who apparently met periodically and presumably discussed these developments. And there were, I think, about 12 volumes, rather heavy folders, hardback covers, in which these reports were bound, not bound, but filed. And every IG plant we went to during April and May, we kept asking as a final question, do you have the QKO reports? And the answer always was, we were directed by Hitler to destroy all of that information, and we did. And so then finally on this trip I mentioned that I took with Dr. Curtis, we went down to Gendorf, Austria, where the polyethylene plant was, which was on the Austrian border. They had built the plant in a group of pine trees. It was well hidden, well camouflaged, and was never bombed. It was not touched by a bomb. So we got the chief chemist there who wasn't particularly cooperative, and he would only tell us what he didn't volunteer information. He would answer what we asked him, but he was not cooperative in the sense that he was proud of what they had done and wanted to get some acknowledgement that it was a good technical work. So we asked him some question about some development on probably on polyethylene, and he said, "I don't know the answer. I'll have to look in the QCO reports." So well, I looked at John Crawford, and he looked at me, and aha! So he reached up on the shelf in the laboratory we were in, pulled down one of these volumes, and found the answer to what we had asked him. So we went on questioning him, and this was in the American zone, so I was in charge of the group. And so I said, "Well, thank you for your information, and we have been instructed to take the QCO reports back to headquarters." And he became very red in the face, and he pounded the table, and he said, "There will be another war." So we knew we were on the IG blacklist after that. But so we got a duffel bag, and we took a duffel bag to hold these volumes of reports, and put them back in the in our, I think we were traveling in an armored car at that time, and took them back with us. And we had quite a discussion on the way back. These four fellows, as I told you, were, four of them were from Britain. They were from Bakelite, from British Plastics, from ICI, and one other plastics firm. And there was Richardson from a firm in Canada. All of them from commercial firms. And we got to talking. We said, "Now look, if we turn these over to the Army, we're never going to see them again." And they all agreed. They'd had enough experience with the Army by that time to know that that was true. So we decided as a group that we should keep those reports, because they were all in German, but they were copious reports. And even the Germans later said one IG plant during the war was never told what the other plant was doing, and they had never seen the actual fellows that were doing the work. Even the authors of those reports had never seen the other fellows' reports on what they were doing. And they all said they learned more from the reports I published in Modern Plastics based on those QCO reports than they ever knew during their employment in the...
So they all, every plant did not have a copy of this set of...
Oh, they had a copy, but they were, I suppose...
But just the manager or the...
Just
the director.
The head fellow, and they were strictly, apparently... They were not allowed to disclose to their staff what the what was going on in the other plants. Yes, the top executive in each plant would have a copy. I say that obviously, and whenever we asked, they said they'd had them, but they were destroyed. And we decided, first of all, that if we ever turned them in, we'd never see them again. And then they decided, well, since I worked for a government organization and didn't have any proprietary axe to grind or any reason to withhold any information that was in those reports, that I was the logical one to keep them. And of course that put the B on me as far as responsibility for keeping them was concerned, but of course, we wrote, when we got back to London, we had to write copious reports on what we had learned about the plastics during our investigations, but we didn't have to disclose any. I guess we didn't disclose that we had these because we hadn't had it. First place, I didn't know German that well that I could read them by myself. Neither could any of the others, and
So your first report was simply based on your observations and interviews with people.
That's right. I'll get to that in a minute. But anyway, I took those reports in the duffel bag when I returned to the United States in July. I took them with me very carefully, made sure that I always had them in my possession, didn't let them get out of sight, and got back to Bowling Field, I think, in Washington, and asked the first thing the customs officer, we had to go through customs. I had a duffel bag, and I guess I had another piece of luggage. Anyway, first he pointed to the duffel bag that had the QCO reports and asked me to open that. Well, actually, in retrospect, I guess it wouldn't have mattered. He wouldn't have known what they were anyway. They would have meant nothing to him. It wasn't any contraband. He wasn't connected to the military. But anyway, I sort of had a resigned expression, I guess, because he says, no, open that other bag, which had all my clothing in it. So I opened that and had nothing to hide. And so I got them back to the Bureau of Standards. Well, then, as you know, I had a girl working for me who had come over from Germany, and she was not a technically trained person, but she could obviously read German with no problem. The technical terms were somewhat of a mystery to her, but she did a very excellent job of translating most of those QCO reports into English, and I at that time had been so much exposed to German that I could detect errors in her translation and could, and of course, as far as the chemical terms were concerned, could put the correct technical term in, so that when she finished editing them, I would take the time to compare her English text with the German text and make whatever corrections were necessary. I lost that knowledge of German. We were about 3 years in the process of translating those. They were long reports. We worked from 45 into 48 translating those reports into English and publishing them in Modern Plastic.
Right.
But first, all those translated reports were submitted to the Department of Commerce for clearance. And through this civilian intelligence group, and the Army, this was in July, August of 45, after we got back, I wrote my detailed, I've gotten 16 or 32 pages of reports on the developments in Germany. The first report actually was published in October 1946, titled Plastics in Germany, 1939-1945. But the report that I submitted to the Department of Commerce, the Army, and they asked for clearance for release of that report to the plastics industry, and the Army said, no, they are secret. We're not releasing them. They were classified secret. And the English report, the reports that the English had, the French had, the Russians had, they, the industries in those countries had free access to all this information, and our firms in this country, they were not getting the information that we picked up.
Mm-hmm.
So there were some professors there connected with that, connected with the investigations on the civilian side, and they were furious. And one of them persuaded me to, that I, of course, I had submitted the report, they had read the report, persuaded me to go ahead anyway and publish it in Modern Plastics, which I agreed to. Boy, when I read of what happened to some of these fellows that published secret reports, I wonder that I was so dumb in those days, maybe. But anyway, I had the same feeling. Well, this isn't fair. The industries have it in England, France, and Germany. Why shouldn't our industry? So I sent a copy to Modern Plastics, had it set in type. by the middle of September, it was when we normally we close our issues, the middle of the month. So the October issue would normally close about the middle of September.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess we had held up and had not scheduled it for the October issue, but President Truman came along in the middle of the month, and he issued an executive order that all of the information acquired in Germany during the war by the technical investigators should be released for distribution to the public. And that saved my neck. And the article appeared in the October issue. The pages are numbered with letters beginning there's 152A, that first report was 152A to 152P.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite a comprehensive report, but it obviously was inserted into the journal, into the magazine at the last minute, and then part two of that report went in the, I believe, the November report, if I recall correctly. It's right here. The December, it was 3 months later, the part two of the plastics in Germany. But in the meantime, in November, there were two other reports from the there was a hiatus there in November. Part two was published in December, and then every month after that, from January 1946 until November 1948, there were one or more reports on the German developments published in Modern Plastics. And finally, the publisher of Modern Plastics sort of said, when are we going to finish up these reports on developments in Germany? They've been going on for over three years. But by that time, we had reached the end of the reports that were really contained new information.
Mm-hmm.
But I got many, many, many letters from industry telling me of the significance and importance of these reports to their industry. There was one published in 1947 on developments in polyurethanes by Dr. Beyer of IG. And I had a letter from one of the chemical executives of the Eastman Chemicals Company later, several years later, in the mid-50s, saying that he wished that they had read the reports on the polyurethane developments back in at the time they were published, and they wished then, later, that they had paid more attention to what I had reported, because they got into the polyurethane field much later than some of the other U.S. firms.
Was the polyurethane information new? I mean, that was a field that was totally unknown here.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Yes, that Dr. Bayer of Germany was the pioneer worker in this field and had done his work during that period beginning, well, perhaps before 1939, but not known here.
Yeah. But what were some of the other things that Americans received, were able to utilize sooner than they would have if it hadn't been for in other words, what other German developments?
That really calls for a...
you mentioned the polyethylene process, proving one over the other.
Well, the polyethylene process, as I pointed out, had actually been developed in the United States before the war started, and the U.S. process had been transmitted through some company affiliation to Germany, the high-pressure process, which was the successful process before the war. So, but it was only during the war. That was just before the start of the war, obviously, and it became the olefin, polyolefin, the polyethylene, polypropylene, and polybutadiene, and so forth. Have all been major developments since the war. They're all polyvinyl pyrrolidone, which is a specialty product, was the subject of one of the Cuco reports. The work by Reppe on the use of acetylene as a basis for plastics was new information to the industry. Polyvinyl carbazole, there was work on polystyrene, which was a great deal of interest. All of these reports, even on the polymethylmethacrylate, I think there was information, specific information that was new to.
About various processes and
from the response with from the response that I got from various executives, and they were very liberal in their expression of appreciation for the time and effort that had been made to give them the results of that work, indicate that. That they were indeed extremely useful to the industry. I have many letters. I'm always surprised by, I've always been surprised during my years serving the plastics industry on the way in which the industry has acknowledged the contributions which we made at the National Bureau of Standards. Mm-hmm. Through an activity of this type, of dissemination of information, as the British were tickled to death to have us publish these reports, you know, because that made them generally available in the literature. They never did it. They had the reports. The ICI, I'm sure, had translated.